This is going to be a little bit different talk. I think you might see some things that you expected in here, but you probably see some things that you didn't expect too. So we'll start with a question. With the insecticides currently available, can we grow, I think this is probably why a lot of you are here, can we grow BT, non-BT cotton profitably? And I think Danny Frommey just answered a lot of that question. I'll just maybe try to answer a little bit more of it. We had 11 studies in the last 2 years in the insect conference at Beltwide that dealt with control of primarily caterpillars in BT cotton, in non-BT cotton, excuse me. And those were scattered through the southeast, the mid-south, and the southwest. So it covered that waterfront pretty well. So I'm just going to summarize those right quick because I have some other things that I want to visit with you about. There are insecticides that are available to protect non-BT cotton, and they've done a good job in the last 2 years in these studies across the belt. Non-BT varieties, like Danny mentioned, are available that yield equivalently with the BT cotton varieties. Non-BT must be managed more intensively. If you're thinking about it from the insect standpoint, these cottons, you need to keep an eye on these cottons. You need to have a consultant or someone looking at these cottons in order to avoid that going without the insurance program that Dr. Frommey mentioned. Insecticide and herbicide costs will be higher I should have put non-BT, really these would be non-transgenics. You're going to have higher costs from the standpoint of the chemical input side. But the higher costs are offset by higher costs for the seed. So that is, you know, I guess each farm and each part of the country, that calculation needs to be made. But the consensus across the belt among in the insect control conference, the Cotton Insect Control Conference in the last 2 years is, yes, non-BT cotton can be grown competitively with BT cotton, cost-wise, yield-wise, from all those standpoints. And the worm control we've got materials that will control the worms. They change a little bit as you go from one side of the belt to the other. Pyrethroids, you know, this is a little bit some might be shocking to some people, but pyrethroids are still effective in some areas, and primarily the Texas high plains. This kind of shocked me, but there's studies in the last couple of years out of Mississippi that showed pyrethroids were effective, and also Virginia. And so, but joining those pyrethroids, we've got some products that have been showing up as effective in these tests. Benevia, Belt, and Belt Plus Pyrethroids, and I left out Coragen. So those products have all shown good promise against bollworms, budworms, and fall armyworms in the tests that have been run in the last couple of years. So I'm going to switch gears a little bit now and talk to you in a little bit different perspective. I call it the 30-30 perspective. That's 30 years and 30,000 feet. I'm going to give you a little bit of my perspective of being a cotton entomologist for a little over 30 years, and it's the overview, the kind of the big picture. I'm try to tell you some things that you might not know, and it might change the way you think about some things. So if you think about BT cotton, we've been growing BT cotton for about 17 years. And historically, if you look at, and this situation's a little bit different with BT, but historically, with insecticides, we get resistance in 10 to 15 years, and with pyrethroids, it was 7. So, you know, I don't know whether we're working on borrowed time or we've just done a good job in managing resistance. But these technologies have not historically lasted forever. They wear out over time. And so I don't know if we're on top of the curve this time or not, but I guess from the insect standpoint, if you look over at the weed science guys, you know, it makes you scratch your head because some of the cracks are showing in those systems. The resistance management and I think the stack BT genes, I think it's clear that those have worked. It's hard to look into that crystal ball and see what the future holds. BT cotton yields have responded to insecticide oversprays in a lot of places in the South, not so much in Texas, but in other spots. which indicates there might be something going on there. We don't know. It's not really been picked up, but there could be the development of something. So that begs the next question. And the next question is, what if we chose or we decided or the decision was made for us to go wholesale to conventional non-BT cotton? What if that happened in any way, you know, through resistance or through whatever, that we just, you know, 1 year didn't have an option or had an option and chose to go non-BT? What would that look like? This doesn't have anything to do with the talk, except that the mule is interested, and I hope you are. Transgenic era. I think in 1996 we entered another era in cotton pest management, or really pest management throughout all the crops, and that's the transgenic era. It's been kind of characterized as preventative and area-wide. So the technologies that we're using in the past were field-specific, and now they're moving increasingly more and more each year to preventative and area-wide. Boll weevil eradication, these are some examples. Insect-resistant crops, herbicide-resistant crops, disease-resistant crops, nematode-tolerant crops, and seed treatments, all of these things you get and you plant and your problems are supposed to be over. Increasingly, pest management has transitioned from season-long scouting, decision-making, and spraying to pest management decisions made and money spent when the seed is purchased. And then whatever happens after that, maybe we have to manage, but we don't manage as intensively, and things are changing in the countryside. So in that 17-year transgenic era, has the infrastructure changed any? What's going on out there in the countryside? Well, you know, most of us just kind of go on year to year, and we don't see that much change, and we don't really think about it. But I got to thinking about the changes that I'd seen in my career. You know, I started out in the Rio Grande Valley in 1981, and those years have passed, and I, you know, visited with some of my friends about it, and I became suspicious that there's some things going on with the infrastructure that are different than there were back then. So let's just think about that a little bit, and I'll just start out from what I saw in the valley, and then we'll go from there. So the valley is a good study area because it's an intensively agricultural area. It's relatively small, and it's got good isolation from other cotton-producing areas and intensive ag areas in Texas and the United States. Not so much from Mexico, but in Texas. So if you look at 1981 and you compare that to 2012, and you look at where we were back in 81, we had 35 to 40 chemical company field men in the valley. In 2012, we had 12 of them. We had 18 crop consultants back in 81, and now we have 5. We had 30 aerial application companies. We've got 5 down there now. We had a fully functional, fully staffed USDA ARS research station. That research station is closed now. We had a fully staffed, fully functioning Texas A&M Research and Extension Center. Now that Research and Extension Center is reduced in staff, and kind of like a lot of the other things, it's diminished. And some of this I noted down there. John Norman is a personal friend and longtime IPM agent and consultant down there. He and I kind of collaborated on these numbers. So that was my first kind of thought on it, and I thought I'd pursue it and see if I could find out how that looked in the rest of the belt. So looking at the crop consultant side, and there's not a lot of information on this. A couple of states have records on their consultants because they license those consultants. So for Arkansas, had data back as far as 2006, and there were 343 consultants in Arkansas in that year. And by 2012, that number had dropped to 248. So in that six-year period, we had a 28% reduction in the number of consultants working in the state of Arkansas. In Louisiana, in 2005, we had 282 consultants. In 2011, we had 183. That's a reduction of 35%. That looks like 85 on here, but it's actually 35. So what about commercial ground applicators. So I have data for these states: Arkansas, Alabama, Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, Missouri, North Carolina, Oklahoma, South Carolina, Texas, Tennessee, Texas, and Virginia. 2005, in those states, there were 14,703 ground applicators, commercial ground applicators. In 2011, that number dropped to 13,684. That's a 6.9% reduction. So we haven't seen quite that reduction in those numbers. So I got a little bit longer window of time in Texas with Texas data. We went from 2000, where we had 2,482 ground, commercial ground applicators. And in 2011, we had 1,745. So over that 11-year period, we had a 30% reduction in ground applicators in the state of Texas. So commercial aerial applicators, what's going on with those guys? I've got data from these states. In 2005, we had 1,588 aerial applicators in those states across the South. 2011, that number had dropped down to 1,413. That's an 11% reduction in about 6 years. So in Texas, we got that longer, a little bit longer time window again. We had data from 2000. We had 746 aerial applicators in the state of Texas. 2011 had 543. That's a reduction of 27% in that 11 years. So what about guys like me? What about extension entomologists with the public sector guys that are there to help farmers? What about those guys? So we did a survey of the southern states entomologists over the last 5 years. And they told us that across their states, the extension entomologists were down by 33% in the last 5 years. So Texas, we had a little bit longer set of data again. In Texas, over the last 20 years, we've had a 45% reduction. What about the ones that are coming? What about these youngsters that are going to step into the places of these older folks like me that are going to retire one of these days? What about those guys? What are the colleges doing? Well, the emphasis is changing, at least in our department it is, and I think in a lot of the others it is too. We're going to genetic and molecular emphasis and away from field-specific emphasis, and the guys that do what I spent a career doing. And so we don't have that group of people coming. And it makes sense. If I were a student in college now and I looked out there and I saw these numbers that I'm presenting and the opportunities, I probably wouldn't do that either. I'd probably go another direction, or I'd try to. So we've crossed the bridge in terms of integrated pest management in cotton, and we've crossed into the transgenic era, and the bridge has fallen into disrepair if we had to go back and do field specific. We don't have the resources to do that. The way back would be long and it would be expensive. It would take a long time to train those young entomologists and get them out there. We'd probably have to restructure in the colleges to be able to, you know, get the kind of education those guys need. We don't have the experienced guys in the colleges anymore. So what are the challenges looking forward in the future? Well, human population growth in the next 40 years is going to be a huge challenge. Here's the trend lines. Up, up, up. We hit 7 billion in 2011, year 2011. We're supposed to have another 4 billion by the year 2050. Can we produce enough? You know, if you think about what kinds of pressures and what kinds of challenges that's going to put on agriculture, it's huge. There's urgency there. We don't have a lot of time. We've got to do some things, and we don't have a lot of time to do those things. Across the board, we've seen reductions in ag infrastructure. The people that help farmers do what they do, the people that help bring on new technology, the people that help farmers learn how and develop and use that technology, we're way down in that across the board. The private sector is market driven. That depends on what farmers want to do, what they're going to spend their money for. The public sector is another matter. The public sector, when we have a failure, the public sector is usually there to try to figure out what to do next. Where do we go? How do we make this work? They help the farmers make that transition into whatever new system we have. We are very diminished in the public sector now. I think with all these things in mind, that the trying to rebuild the infrastructure that supports agriculture in this country, and I'm not just talking about cotton, I'm talking across the board, is it urgent right now as it has been any time in the last 30 years? And that concludes my remarks. I guess I did that pretty good. Thank you for listening, and if I can, I guess I probably don't have any time for questions.
We'll have some time for discussion.
Okay.
Thank you, Charles. I think that's a very interesting perspective that certainly has something relates to conventional, but as well as our whole agricultural production system, in particular with cotton. Thank you.